This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Port. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And dear listeners, I haven't seen Jonathan in about a month. And I have to say, I really did not miss him.
At all.
Nothing. To be said.
You feel nothing?
No, nothing. I forgot that you existed. But anyway, how are you, Wit?
I am perfectly well, thank you. And perfectly okay with you not missing me.
Oh, perfect. I thought you were going to say perfectly okay with living in South Africa because... I don't think that's the case at the moment. Everything's up in the air and up to shit.
No, I've written South Africa off. It's fucked.
Already?
Yeah. No, I did last year already. I think I said on one of our podcasts that I didn't think this place was salvageable. I don't. I do think you'll be able to survive here. That's a different argument.
Yeah.
But salvageable, nah, done.
So I listened to a podcast by Alec Hogg. From Biz News, I think. It's called The Rational Perspective. It's quite interesting. So he had a chap called Yaki Salias on, who is the CEO of the Institute of Security Studies.
Yeah.
And his argument about expropriation without compensation was that Cyril is trying to reform and modernize the ANC to become a 21st century sort of social democratic party, as opposed to the rural traditionalist party that it has been for the past 100 years. And he's using EWC to give poor black people property rights. And the big fight will actually be between the traditional leaders and the ANC. And, I mean, what do you think about that, just off the top of your head?
I think it's a novel premise. But there's a whole bunch of other problems related to it.
Right, but I think it's bullshit. If it was just EWC, I'd be like, okay, maybe there's a point to it. But it's NHI, it's the new BEE code, it's the mining charter, it's the shit economy, it's the rotation of the shitty cabinet members, it's the fucking blatant thieving every single day. Mm. I don't see like a grand strategy chess move here.
The notion that Cyril Ramaphosa wants to empower poor people. Where's the data for that? Where's any impetus for that? You're arguing one policy that will not empower poor people. That's the other thing, is that there's no economic argument to be made there either. Because
which policy?
EWC is not going to empower. It's not actually going to empower poor people.
Well, I mean, if you give people in traditional areas proper land rights and title deeds and encumbered title to the land, that's very empowering.
Sure. But if you do that through EWC, you've made title deeds worthless.
Well, no, you expropriated from traditional leaders. You expropriated from the trusts, the Nkonyama Trust.
The problem is that as it currently stands, the Nkonyama Trusts are the owners of that land. If you think that land was taken illegally in some way, stolen or unfairly removed from individuals, that's fine. There's a restitution process. It's already in the Constitution.
But it's state land.
And we should... Yeah, so what I'm saying is that you don't get to win the argument by poor people get... title deeds when chiefs currently own those title deeds, and that's going to be a good thing, but won't affect anyone else in the country and won't affect the value of title deeds. If they come and take my title deed on my house, well, from the bank, but if they come and take that title deed, it will affect the economy as negatively as it will affect them taking the title deed away from the chief. So it may be the argument there is whether it's just or not to take it. But I still think the bottom line is the economic value of trust in property rights and trust in the economy, and both of those will vanish, whichever one of the two you take away.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some merit to the case that if you take away the Nkonyama Trust is owned by the king and the minister of housing and some other state entity or some sort. Mm. If you take away their complete power and you give everyone deeds to the property they're actually living on, is it expropriation? You're expropriating from the state itself. It's essentially state-owned land at the end of the day, if you think about it. So,
but then why do you need an EWC bill?
That's the key. Why do we need that? So why change the constitution?
I would assume that at a point when the state turns around to the chief and goes, hey, listen, we're giving away the land, I assume as the second party, as owner of that land, the chief goes, no, you're not.
Yeah.
It's my land.
But that's why AfriForum, the traditional leaders, Gatfor Capetonian, and maybe Oranje should like have a loose affiliation together. Form a coalition for property rights. How cool will that be? Well, against the state.
Sure. I think next year's elections are the most interesting thing I'm going to find about next year's elections. Not the most exciting thing. The most exciting thing is going to see Musi Maimane cry. But kind of like Sergio Ramos at the World Cup when Spain loses.
Yeah, but Sergio has talent.
That is true. That is true. But he's a dick. But other than seeing Musi Maimane cry as an exciting point of next year's elections, the interesting point is going to be Cope's gain in vote, which is, I think, going to be directly as a result of where they stand on land. I am seriously considering voting for them.
Yeah.
And I don't think they fall where I would like them to on many issues.
Well, I don't know any other issues that Cope has. All I know is their land stuff, because that's what they've been doing lately.
Well, lately. In the past, they've been involved in other smaller issues, and they've usually backed the opposition wherever the opposition's gone. But they are a splinter group, essentially, of the ANC.
Sure.
So they have many of the same policies.
Well, they're the Black Consciousness splinter group, I remember. ANC and the SACP have this unholy communist communion from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Mosiwe Lekota was Black Consciousness who went into the ANC.
So he's Hotep.
Yeah, so he's like the Hotep version of the ANC, and that's why he left, I suspect. But if nothing else comes up, yeah, Cope might be a good reason. But perhaps something else comes up, who knows.
I just think it'll be an interesting barometer of backing one issue that I think a lot of people are actually quite against, and realize the damage it could do, the wholesale damage. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that government has done, has in front of it that it wants to do. And expropriation without compensation, and I would argue NHI, are the two things that will destroy the country imminently. Like, so when I said this country's written off, yeah, it's written off, but it could take 20 or 30 years to get there.
Yeah, but we must remember how bad the ANC is at implementing anything. So, I mean, you can have these, they've been very good at implementing BEE, for example, because Wapenhoek Capital co-opted the ANC right at the beginning to implement BEE codes.
Monopoly Capital. Large organizations.
Momentum was like 100% white when it started. Don't fucking come here with your nonsense.
Yeah, and Cyril and Tokyo and all their mates were also happy with the policy.
And they were co-opted into it. They were the beneficiaries of the policy. So it will be very interesting to see for EWC and NHI if corporations are co-opted and play along. I think for NHI, Discovery is like sort of playing along at the moment.
Yeah.
Apparently they're going to help the state to do various things for the NHI. I'll be very happy if Discovery just is, you know, the whole public health service is outsourced to Discovery. I think it'll be a lot better anyway. If that's NHI, I support it. But I don't think that is NHI.
No, it's not NHI. Look, just the pushback on the WMC thing before we get into NHI, which is quite a lengthy discussion, but my problem with WMC is it's a Gupta term, it was created entirely to cause division, and it has no meaning other than to cause effectively hatred. So if it's being used as a parody or satire, as you often use it, I don't have a problem with it. But as a serious term.
Yeah,
I think it's a load of horseshit.
But fucking white minority capital hours, Jonathan. Every morning, 4:30, you must tweet it. Then you're part of the gang.
So
of course it's a parody.
So,
but yes,
yeah. Look, with regards to Discovery's involvement, the rumor, and it's not stamped out yet. But it's the rumor is that Discovery would essentially manage the entire NHI in the same way they manage their medical scheme. So if you everyone in the country becomes a member of a national health. So if you have a medical aid, well, you wouldn't anymore, or you might have it over and above, but your medical aid would now be called national health. You'd have a little card probably. And when you phoned to find out which hospital you can go to, because that's part of the program, you'd phone a call center. That call center would be run by Discovery. You'd be on a database. That database would be ostensibly run by Discovery.
Right. So it's sort of like the NHS in a way.
Mm.
Sort of same model.
Sure. And then when you wanted to get an authorization to have your operation at whichever hospital they told you had to go to and whichever doctors they told you had to use.
3 years after the fact.
Yes. That all would be managed by Discovery.
Right.
This is a coup for them, if true, because they go from having 2.5 million, roughly, members on their current medical scheme
to like 50.
To 55 million, and they charge an administration fee for that. And as a company, that's a very clever move. 55 million people admin fee or 2.5 million, it's a no-brainer. You take the 55 million. That said, bigger on the NHI is that the NHI is a catastrophic design for this country.
But the problem is we just don't know yet, not because it hasn't been implemented properly, that's not a socialism argument, but the bills and the papers are so vague on it. So perhaps what I'm trying to see is Discovery and other health insurance, whatever, hospital groups coming in and saying, oh, let's help you, and they will dilute it as much as possible or take on the responsibilities for profit. I'm not going to deny them that, but take on the responsibility to actually make it work in a way that is better than the current health system and that will not destroy healthcare in the future. Can that be a possibility?
So I don't think it can, and I think the entire system goes against liberty. It is it's going to enforce slavery in the medical profession.
Well, been there already.
Which has been there already, but hasn't been there in the private sector. It's going to tell doctors what they will, and all healthcare providers, physiotherapists, nurses, etc., what they will and won't charge for certain procedures, where they can and can't do those procedures, and basically, it's going to destroy the medical field in that sense.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the idea that it can't be implemented. So we discussed a little bit before the show, the thought that, well, it's kind of like e-tolls. You mentioned that. You can put e-tolls in. They don't work. Nobody pays them. Good for you. That's great. So will it work like that? Or will it work more like something like BE, where they've co-opted large organizations? And I think it'll work more like BE. And the reason is because the hospital groups will play along.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. Because business, we defend them to the hilt for some reason, but they are not very brave when it comes to fighting for the rights of themselves and the people.
They're not brave at all. They're not brave at all. And look, I said 2008, I think it was, when this all came about, that what I really think happened with Aaron Motsoaledi is he sat down with his advisors when he was first appointed health minister, and he said, what do I need to fix health? And, you know, anyone sort of half informed would have said, look, you really need about 300 to 400 extra hospitals countrywide. And then on top of that, you're going to need between 5,000 and 10,000 new specialists. And he would have said, And he would have said, How do I go about achieving that? And they would have said, look, two ways. One is you can build capacity over 40 to 50 years.
With a huge cost.
With economic growth and whatever.
Yeah.
Well, there would have been a whole bunch of advice given to him as well. They would have said, look, you can allow private medical training.
But that's the
which
thing.
He's rejected.
So we know what the goal is. The goal is to build 500 new hospitals and get 10,000 new specialists. What's the easy way to get that? To deregulate the medical, the medical field. What does Aaron do? The commie bastard. Oh, that's terrible. There'll just be more profits made. And the people will suffer. So fuck you, I'm going to do it myself. Well, I'll just force them
If he goes with that option, the biggest problem is that what does government own in that system? Nothing. They don't own it. They don't control it.
If he, billions to steal.
If he regulates that, that basically the private sector is illegal, which is what this ultimately does. The private sector as it exists currently is illegal. Then he gets to hijack a working private system, include it into the public system.
Yeah.
And he probably truly believes this will work. I was told last week that apparently the anesthetic anesthetic association has something like 450 specialists who have kind of said that they're out. If this, if any of this comes to fruition, they're gone. So that's 450 anesthesiologists disappeared. And I can tell you that it's the same for everyone in every discipline.
Oh, sure.
I counted when Aaron was making this announcement, I was thinking about it, and there's eight doctors I know who are leaving the country, either have left from about March of this year to December of the end of the year. That's just in my personal sort of friend circle that are leaving. That's a mix of race, Indian, black, white, male, female, married, not married. I know someone who's giving up a surgical speciality to leave and go to a Western country. I know someone who's very talented and intelligent who's leaving after community service and is going to probably be a superstar where they go. It's the flight is unbelievable currently. Yeah,
and it hasn't even started.
And it's not even started. They're saying 2026 for all of this. That's actually the sort of start date.
But I mean, by then I think the ANC won't be in power. So
I think you're very optimistic.
Really? Yeah. Don't you think 2024 is like the watershed election?
I always thought 2028 was the watershed.
Oh.
And I'm less convinced now because I made that sort of prediction when Helen Ziller was the head of the DA, and it was shortly after she had taken over, and things just kept moving in the right kind of direction. The DA, and they weren't always liked by everyone and all of that.
Well,
exactly, but they had direction. They understood where they were going. They understood what they stood for, and I don't think the DA understands at all what they stand for currently.
No.
And they seem quite lost. I mean, Gareth van Onselen made another great point the other day about Solium Simang is standing for, I think, yeah, it's Solium Simang.
Yeah, the federal chair of Gauteng.
He's standing for, yeah, the head. He wants to be the premier candidate for Gauteng. And he made the point that this guy's just taken over in Pretoria as like mayor of Pretoria, which is not a non-prestigious role.
And now he's just dumping them.
And why would you just dump that role and dump the citizens you supposedly say you give so much of a shit about for the power grab to be Gauteng? And what he was pointing to also was the depth, because the DA always says they have great depth of leadership. Okay, so where's your depth?
Yeah, not at the top level.
Well, I don't think they do have great depth, because the way the DA creates leaders, what they think, because this is the thing, you don't create leaders, and they still haven't learned that. But you've got to go to DA school, right?
Yeah, they do have this curriculum.
And then, so Ramon, you could never, if you decided tomorrow you were a big voter all of a sudden, and you really believed in everything the DA stood for, and of course everything your wife has earned is because of her white privilege.
Yes.
If you just sign that on a document and also say that you're going to vote, then they let you, of course, become a member. And you said, look, I think I've got a lot to offer and I've got these skills, and so therefore I'd like to run for a leadership position, or I'd like to take on a certain role. They'd go, no. No, sorry, Ramon, you haven't been to the school.
You haven't been indoctrinated enough.
Exactly. By us. You've got to go to the school.
Because you have these horrible ideas of that, what? Capitalism frees people? No. We can't have that. We need to show you how the state frees people, Ramon.
Yeah.
I assume that's why I was so surprised when Gwen went straight to MP. Like, she was headhunted as policy head, and she says, no, fuck you, make me MP as well, then I'll join. And it's a lot more powerful for her. So kudos. I mean, she worked there way before. So
Gwen
is very rare.
Gwen is a rare example. And although I think Gwen did actually attend their school at some point.
Right at the beginning,
DA youth leader thing for a year, if I'm not mistaken. But although Gwen's a very free thinker, and she absolutely deserves that position, and she's a enigma in the DA in the sense that she really is a leader.
I don't know if she's well liked for the moment, but we'll see. I had dinner with her a few weeks back, and she's such a free thinker, so to speak, that if you say taxation is theft, she gets apoplectic with rage. No, it's not theft. I mean, you can have this whole argument with her about taxation being theft, but she doesn't convince me, of course, but anyone who's watching would be like, yeah, Gwen's right. Reminds me of just being a moron, which happens all the time because I'm an anarchist.
Your man, her position.
I'm a free thinker. Well, no, it's a price you pay for civilization. People get left behind, and tax is a price you pay for being a citizen of the country. It's a bit like Nicholas Taleb. I don't know if you saw that post I put up in the Renegade Report group yesterday about having skin in the game.
Sorry, I did see.
Being a citizen of the country, if you go to a country and you just reside there without taking citizenship, you actually shouldn't deserve to be in that country, because citizenship gives you the rights but obligations too. So, for example, it gives in America, if you're a citizen of America, you are taxed on your worldwide income. If you're an immigrant and you just become a resident and never become a citizen, there's no skin in the game for you. You shouldn't actually be in that country in the first place because you don't want to partake as a citizen of the country. You're just there to basically leech off the system. I think the principle is fine. The example of worldwide tax, like, I wouldn't fucking do that. I'll be a resident forever and not a citizen.
And take the US as an example, because that's in the news on immigration. If you go there legally, then you do get a green card. And a green card isn't citizenship, but it does allow you to work. And it also means you're registered with the IRS. So you end up paying tax even as a non-citizen, but as a resident of the country, essentially. So I think a little bit of nuance to his argument, but I don't disagree necessarily with the premise.
I think it makes good points. I think it does make good points. So for those who haven't read my review yet, I read Adam Sritz's
Kill the Boer.
He gave it to me a few weeks ago, and Report asked me to write a review for it. And I must be honest, we are like quite pro the idea that farm murders are a problem.
Yeah. And very anti the idea that there's a white genocide.
Yeah, same as Ernst. In fact, in the book, he writes it quite clearly there. The white genocide, the reality is already fucked up. We don't need to add layers of rhetoric on top or hyperbole to dismiss the reality.
And we damage messaging, which we'll talk about just now, by doing that. But carry on.
And that's what he says in the book. And I must admit, I think the book is one of those books where, if you want to learn about a subject, you have to read like that one. You have to read that book. Like, if you want to learn about atheism, you read Richard Dawkins. God does not exist. What does he call it? The God Delusion.
The God Delusion.
Every atheist in the world read that first as a teenager. Like, oh, fuck. Boom. Mind changed. Kill the Boer is exactly the same for farm murders. It's really, really good. It's distressing, though. Not an easy read. Not for sensitive readers. But if you want to learn and understand the stats, understands the most important part, the zeitgeist, where you have this, the cultural milieu of whiteness and land settlers and land thieves and racist farmers and all this other stuff that's put into the narrative, that, you know, farmers are not actually victims of anything. Very persuasive book. I recommend that everyone gets it. Should be out by now.
Yeah, it is out. It was launched over the weekend.
Yeah, and I attended the media launch as Renegade Report.
Yeah,
come to the launch.
No worries.
Okay, fine. No worries. I'll come. And interesting at the media launch, so a lot of the English media were there, whereas they normally wouldn't attend. And they were actually quite, how can I explain? They did not believe him outright, but they were a lot less hostile than I expected. So, I mean, we'll see. Read the book. Let me know what you think. I think it's
an interesting point I noticed about the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post did a video last week about farm murders.
Yeah.
Which was...
in the Free State.
Very reasonable.
That was superb.
And actually dealt with the problem in a completely open and truthful manner, without any spin, without any of the usual sort of identity politic or the leftist agenda of the Huffington Post.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking if maybe the Huffington Post could be convinced to be a market entity. Like is there a part of them, because they're people at the end of the day, it's not just an organization,
yeah,
that go, yeah, all right, this is something that is actually truthfully an issue, and we can still sell things by tapping into this market if we're honest about their problem.
Sure.
It was a. I just thought for a moment maybe they could just turn and be like a news organization, yeah, not a blog.
Well, ironically, I think the Huffington Post documentary, it's only like 7 or 8 minutes
long. Yeah, short.
Is better than Lawrence Southern's Farmlands.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Farmlands.
Okay.
I'll watch it at some point.
It's very well produced. But the poverty porn is outrageous. The white poverty porn, the preppers. If I knew nothing about South Africa, I would think, oh shit,
the whites are being fucked.
Yeah, yeah. But living in South Africa, it seems quite disingenuous. I think it's interesting to watch because it's actually a good documentary.
The thing is, does she say, look, these are the whites in South Africa, or does she make it clear that these are specific whites in South Africa?
All the Afrikaners. She's talking about the Afrikaners.
Yeah, you see, that's an unreliable. But
she goes like to the Karoo, to like a farm.
Yeah.
And she goes like to a squatter camp. And she's like, I just became aware of squatter camps for white people. I'm like, okay, they exist, I'm sure. But then like, go to Sandton. Just take a photo of people of all races and ethnicities, like having coffee at Starbucks.
Yeah.
Because that's also South Africa.
Yeah.
Not absolutely. Just this stuff.
Or you want to talk about Afrikaners, go to Menlyn. Go to Menlyn Shopping Mall, yeah, and walk around there. Most of the people are probably of Afrikaans descent.
Go to the fucking Barnyard Theatre.
And they're just okay, you know?
Go to the Barnyard Theatre in East Rand Mall.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if there's one there, but I don't go to Barnyard or East Rand Mall. But I mean, they exist.
You're stereotyping.
I mean, they exist, but speak to farm workers, for God's sake. Like the Huffington Post video, there was no narration and we couldn't see who was the interviewer. All we saw were people talking to the camera.
Yeah.
The farm workers are saying, we feel threatened. You know, my boss was killed 5 years ago and I'm still in shock. You speak to relatives of people who were killed in the Free State. It was a much more honest piece of film than Lawrence Southern.
Look, Lawrence Southern's selling a narrative, and that's, yeah, what I realized with a lot of the people selling that narrative. There's some people who've actually made almost a business for themselves at the moment, selling the South African white narrative, the South African genocide narrative, all of which I find, as I said, very unhelpful. Just on that whole messaging point, I made a point on Twitter with regards to Cape Town and not necessarily day zero, but with regards to their dams. We had the same thing with Johannesburg. 2 years ago, I think it was, we had a drought in Johannesburg. I mocked Katie Katapoda mercilessly about it.
But she said it would take like 6 years to get the dams right.
They said it would take 5 years to refill the Vaal Dam. It took three months.
Yeah.
They did the same thing for Cape Town. They turned around and they said it's going to take 7 to 10 years to recover from this drought. It looks like it'll take less than two. Now, that's still significant, and there was still a significant drought, and the drought caused significant suffering and economic losses and all those things. Here's the problem. The issue is that when you want to make a prediction, you want to tell someone there's a problem here. Why are they choosing the most? I'm sure, like on the graph that they have, based on trends, so that they can predict the future, they have a mean and perhaps a median, depending on how the data is distributed, and then they have extremes on either side.
Yeah.
The problem is that instead of saying, look, it's probably going to take us 2 to 3 years to refill the dam and recover from this, they go, no, let's pick the most extreme number we can find on this graph. It's going to take us 10 years to refill this dam. Then when it doesn't take 10 years...
They don't just pick an arbitrary number, Jonathan. Surely they don't pick an arbitrary number. No, they just say, just based on what we have at the moment.
The number may very well be based on data they have. What I'm saying is that they always pick the most excruciating number. And then the problem is when that doesn't come true, as it almost inevitably won't, because you pick the extremes, and extremes don't happen often, then people don't believe you. You've cried wolf. And this happens repeatedly. And people who don't understand why sometimes individuals won't buy global warming or climate change. The reason they might not do that is because in 2006 or whatever it was, you said that the ice caps would be melted by now. Yeah. And they aren't, right?
They've grown.
So maybe someone who believed you has now 10 years later turned around and gone, holy crap, they were lying, right? And your whole message is dissolved. And this is happening across the board with expertise. Journalists do this all the time. They do
some expertise.
Yeah. But let me use doctors as an example. Imagine if you went to a doctor and you were like, oh, doc, my knee's sore. And I was like, cancer.
You got 3 months.
Definitely cancer. You know, let's work out your day zero. Sorry about that. Doc, I feel like I got flu. Not flu, throat cancer. Definitely throat. The problem is if that happened, that doctor would very quickly lose all credibility. And if all doctors did that, the medical profession would lose all credibility and you wouldn't consider them experts because you'd feel better after 3 days. Your flu would disappear. You'd find out, shit, I don't have throat cancer. He said it was knee cancer before, throat cancer this time. Yeah. Oh, well.
So what is your over... So, I mean, do you think people are using the worst case scenario all the time without expressing
nuance about different
possibilities?
The so-called elites and the so-called government, I'm not one of these sort of globalization conspiracy theorists, but you see it with everything, with Brexit, right? Instead of being honest about Brexit, and they say the entire economy will collapse if we go Brexit.
Yeah.
Now, not only did the average person in the street go, I think that's probably unlikely, but now it didn't happen.
No, the reverse happened.
And so the problem you have now is that the next time you want to sell a message, it's even harder. The same with Trump.
But why are you moaning about our enemies selling the wrong message?
Because it's not only our enemies, it's the entire discussion, it's the entire public discourse is based on this hysteria. I look at America recently. America protects their borders. This is not a controversial position. Yeah, I don't care what anyone says. We've got one crazy libertarian. He's going to go nuts because I call them that, who listens to the show who doesn't believe in borders. But 30 years ago, if you had said, ask any American, even 20 years ago,
Barack Obama in 2005.
Sure. Do you believe we should protect our borders and stop illegal immigration? The agreement rate was basically all close in the 90s. Okay. Most people believe that you should protect their borders.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't say anything about the argument at hand, though. Hold on.
Even today, the polling says that most people, even Democrats, believe that there should be protection of the borders.
Sure.
Then because you've got a guy in power who you don't like, now there's a freak out because you protect the borders and there's something that results as part of protecting the borders, which is correctly a shitty policy that needs to be changed.
The separation of children.
The separation of kids.
Yeah. But it's been a policy since when?
Well, it's quite complicated because
there was a court case.
Originally they didn't separate the parents from the kids, and then there was a court case.
I mean, we don't need to go into detail, but it's been there for much longer than Trump has been in power.
So essentially, the court case made it illegal to not separate the children,
right?
Which meant Barack Obama had to separate the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Trump had to separate the kids, and in fact, Trump's executive order
solved
the problem, but is currently illegal.
Probably.
So, in other words, if you wanted to challenge Trump and be like, screw you, you could take his executive order and it would lose to the court.
Well, that's his first action as a dictator by signing an executive order that prohibits ICE from removing children from their parents. That's his first act of tyranny. Not to think about it.
Well, he's violated
there we go.
The law. Yeah, he's broken the law.
He's breaking the law. I mean, the border thing is such a fucking mess, to be honest with you. I think, but the best thing now, Mexico has a socialist president, a brand new one. So I suspect Mexico will build the wall and pay for it. I mean, that's what socialists do, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't want any of that crummy American stuff coming into your country.
Now, what Trump needs to do is be like, Mexicans, you are fleeing an oppressive regime. We will give you easy asylum. Because you're fleeing socialism, that would fuck everyone. because the new Mexican president said it's a human right to move to America as a Mexican.
Yes, I know.
Trump should do it. I think he would get so much support. It's like, Mexicans, you're fleeing oppression. now that you've got a socialist president, come over to America. We'll give you easy asylum.
He's not going to do that.
I know. I would do it,
because
though.
He hasn't done shit about people in Venezuela, for example.
I would do it, though.
Yeah, I know. But you like to just fuck with things for the sake of it. Just on this border thing and just in general, it's also becoming a trend, yeah. Is this idea that if you cry about something, you know, if you're really emotional, if you have tears,
yeah,
then that matters more. That's an issue we should all take notice of. So
that's what people accused us of with that waitress tip. White tears made us raise money for her.
Yeah, except we never cried and we never broke down.
And we never saw her.
It was never an emotional issue.
Yeah.
So that was their projection. But what I'm saying is, I'm talking about Rachel Maddow breaking out in tears when she reads...
Jose from Guatemala.
No, no, there was some childhood detention or toddler refuge, I don't know, some word she read, and then she had to hold on just for a second, and then she like turned off camera and you know, got a fake tear on, and Jimmy Kimmel holding up his kid on his show.
But it wasn't fake, John. It was real.
Yeah, sure.
It was real. But there's no cell phone footage of the drone strikes bombing Yemeni children. So
well this is,
and if there was,
well, that would...
They would cry about that. And I think they should.
Well...
Same as farm murders here. Johan Berger...
I don't think they should cry about any of it.
No, man. What I'm trying to say is... cash and transit heists. We see videos, cell phone footage of these fuckers with the AK-47s, 20 of them blowing a cash van up. Mm. Have you ever seen a video, cell phone footage of a farmer being murdered?
Yeah.
Imagine we were able to see that as frequently as we saw cash and transit heists. We would be far more worried about farm murders. And that's the thing. It's the essence of reporting is that we only report what we can see, and we react to what we can see only.
So there's a good book, Paul Bloom, Against Empathy.
Yeah, which I haven't read, but which I know of.
Which argues essentially against empathy as a very great negative.
And a good friend of mine argued that's why he was against our tip for the waitress.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean the tip for the waitress, just to...
Oh, we don't need to bring it up. I'm just saying people used Paul Bloom's argument against us.
Yeah, fine.
For that.
And it sticks. And sure. The reason why it sticks is because he makes exactly that point about, for example, if you did have footage of them bombing the kids with drone strikes, then you'd be all empathetic towards these dying children from a drone strike. Perhaps not thinking about the bigger picture. And he talks a lot about that empathy makes you focus in on a specific problem without considering the greater issues in the world.
Yeah.
And this happens all the time, even with charities, for example. He talks about, forget the term. So there's different types of altruism. The one is makes you feel warm and fuzzy.
Sure.
You donate to multiple charities, you give them a little bit, and they can actually do very little with your money, or it even costs them to collect your money. Whereas if you took all that money and gave it to one charity, they'd actually be able to effect something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a movement called effective altruism,
yeah,
which does rank charities and all that. Like yeah. That.
Yeah, empathy, and so I'm just raising the point that we just need to be careful about, because people are crying, because they're shouting and screaming, because they can show us their suffering over another group of people that can't or aren't seen. You need to be really, really careful about that.
I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, if I see like pets getting abused, I don't cry, but I get like angry and whatever.
Sure.
Because, I don't know, I think like dogs have more consciousness than humans for some reason. It's on some sort of level because they can't really control
it. They are sentient, but I don't know about more consciousness. But
they can't control the destiny as much as a human being. Like if, for example, that woman from Guatemala walked across the whole of Guatemala and her child was in the cover of the Time front page and it was fake because they just put her down for like 1 minute and then picked her back up.
Yeah.
Okay, like she sort of knew the risks of doing that because she did it once already and was deported once already. So she sort of knew the risks. So my empathy was less for her than seeing a dog chained up being abused, because the dog can't control his destiny, if that makes sense.
Yeah, although the argument there would be, well, where's your empathy for the kid? Because the kid's the same as the dog. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, the kid didn't really suffer in that regard.
I think we disagree slightly on all we're dogs and humans for, but the point's well made.
Yeah. And that's the big problem with the Farmlands documentary.
Yeah.
Like it's just like white people everywhere in a documentary, and I'm not gonna lie. I mean, people have it bad here. I'm not gonna lie. People do have it bad, but give a bit of context. Give the stats about farm murders. Like, just say, like, these seem to be targeted, unique murders. That's why they're different from the 19,000 other murders that, you know, in a year. Give that, but don't just show a woman crying for like half an hour. It tugs at your heartstrings, but it says nothing about the greater picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we can get to a couple of questions we had, because I just threw out a tweet before we started the show. So how to best go about a tax revolt? And the answer to that is to emigrate.
Well, just don't pay it. I think that's the first step, isn't it?
No, it's not. I think, look, for you, that might work because you work for yourself. So any income you make is in your bank account, and then you have to tell SARS what you made, and then you pay SARS. And if you don't pay it, assumptively, they throw you in prison because taxation is theft, Gwen. If there were enough of you, then they wouldn't be able to throw you all in prison. The problem is that the majority of people in this country who are employed, because we have such a negative approach to entrepreneurship, are employed by companies and employed even by government. Remember, they employ 3 million people.
I mean, did you see that some of the most requested jobs are in the state? They had a survey at a university.
Well, the bartenders in Parliament are earning 280,000 rand a year.
Yeah.
So.
No, but there was, in terms of where people wish to work, like the state, parastatals and state were the two highest employer, people wanted to work there the most. I'm not surprised, but it's really disheartening.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I wonder, 70% of the electorate vote for socialism, basically.
Yeah.
If you vote ANC, EFF, a lot of the other smaller parties, like 70% of the country just wants socialism at the end of the day. So like, I'm not going anywhere for the moment, but just have that in the back of your mind all the time.
Yeah. Look, I don't know if they want socialism. I think that they just don't realize.
No, but that's a soft bigotry thing, with respect, Jonathan. I think most voters don't know anything about policy whatsoever.
No.
Don't get me wrong.
But even socialists, when they, you know, you've got these democratic socialists in America, and they're like, it's just healthcare like Denmark with democracy. And you're like, no, fuckbag. Socialism is seizing the means of production. It's when government, if that's what you want, then that's what I'm saying,
then
when people don't necessarily understand it.
Yeah, then own it. I mean, Russell Lamberti has a new definition, which is technocratic socialism, where you control the means so much, you may as well own it, but you don't give the opponent the satisfaction of saying, oh, look, they own the means. No,
yeah.
They control it in such a way that
you regulate it so that it's under your control.
And that's what the ANC is doing.
Been
doing.
So tax revolts, because you can't really, most people in this country can't get away from it. I don't think there'll ever be a true tax revolt.
Because most people don't fucking pay tax.
I think, well, but that's also true. But I think currently we're having a tax revolt. The hundreds or thousands, and it's probably going to be by the next 2-3 years, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people leaving the country who are intelligent, who have got degrees and skills and all of those things.
Just say taxpayers. That's all inferred.
They're leaving, and that's basically your tax
revolt. I just want to raise a glass to Tom Moyani for being 200 billion rand below or whatever, and all the tax evaders and tax avoidance. South Africa would be Venezuela if it weren't for you. So I salute you people. I think you are saving us from being Venezuela in 3 years' time. So keep doing what you're doing, and more people should support the tax evaders and tax avoiders. And Tom Moyane should be reinstated. I agree with the EFF completely in that regard. I'm not joking. I sound sarcastic, but I'm really not joking.
Yeah, well, because if SARS is inefficient, there's at least the economy will keep ticking, and there'll be less for the politicians to steal.
To some degree.
That being your point. Okay, here's a question. Sorry, there was a question that was a little bit off. So I'm not going to read it, but it referred to Judas Malema's junk. But the debate about proportional representative parliamentary systems, which one would suit us best?
Well, we've got a proportional one.
Yeah.
Which technically means no vote is wasted. So the DA's thing about if you vote for a small party, you waste your vote, that's not really true. I quite like the constituency system, to be honest, but I would prefer the canton system of Switzerland if I had to choose one electoral system. Basically, you just vote within your district, and your district's autonomous from the next district. That seems more fair to me.
Yeah, I'd be actually be fine. I don't think we'd get to the canton system. And I, given our...
Maybe de facto we will.
Yeah, maybe. Given the way our country is actually structured and set up currently, I think a representative system would work much better.
Me too.
Yeah. I do think... I also... I really wish we could break the sort of party control, and I suppose this even in representative systems like the US, for example, there's still party control, but you do get individuals voting against their party. That actually does happen, and it's quite interesting to see in South Africa, for example, the DA always criticized the ANC when they were a much smaller party. They always criticized the ANC for always voting together as a bloc. And they said that was a show of their ideology, but also their weakness in that everyone had to think the same.
Sure.
And now, given the same opportunity, the DA does exactly the same thing.
When you go after stupid voters, you play stupid games and you lose stupid games. The DA still thinks they can govern. Their slogan is ready to govern. You're not going to fucking govern, dude. Ever. You're not going to get 51%.
Isn't that the EFF slogan?
Ready to govern. Yeah. No, that's the DA slogan.
What's the name? Ready? What's government in waiting, the EFF?
Yeah, government in waiting. When? 2055, perhaps. But who knows? Is that all the questions?
It seems people not engaging very well this morning.
Well, you only put it on like half an hour ago.
No.
What do you want to talk about?
have we reached that point, Ramon? Really?
No, I had a lot to talk about, but I...
Someone's asked about... we've discussed it already, but people immigrating and reasons. I mean, reasons really is because...
because they fucking want to. I don't care.
It's because they want to and they see better opportunity, and in many cases, they're correct. I think South Africa's got a lot to offer. I think it always has. But the problem is that a lot of those things are vanishing because... If you were successful in South Africa, you lived quite a high quantity of life. I don't like quality of life because I think quality is very debatable. So you can not being able to walk in a street at night is definitely a negative quality.
Well, you can in Waterfall Estate. In the Republic of Waterfall, as it will be known in about 10 years' time, or the Republic of Danefern.
Sure, small enclaves, as you like to call them.
Yeah.
But generally in the country, you can't.
White ghettos.
If you're actually successful in life, you don't want to live anywhere in those places. So I'm talking about if you're actually successful, then you can't walk in the road. But you do have quantity. So you get a lot of stuff, equal success.
You used to.
Yeah. So that's what's changing is the quantity has dropped. The quantity of what you get for your success is decreasing.
Yeah. I mean, I know people.
And the risk is increasing.
I know people in Southeast Asia, like one guy, chap lives in Indonesia and one chap lives in Thailand. They get the equivalent of about between $8,000 to $10,000. So here, the equivalent in real terms is like 80,000 to 100,000 rand salary, which is a very good salary here. But over there, the parity is just so much bigger. They got like on 100,000 rand, he's got a chauffeur, a chef, and like a housekeeper for his massive flat.
Yeah,
and he can walk in the street if he wants to, and he can he's like Dan Bilzerian in Indonesia with like like 0.1% of the wealth. So the money goes a lot further there.
Yeah,
than here. It used to be like that here, but now it's become a lot more expensive to have that same quality of life.
I think it's interesting though, because for example, Australia, you can't have that quality of life either, even if you earn quite a fair amount of money. Even the wealthy in a place like Australia, except I'm not talking about the super rich, but the relatively wealthy, they don't have chefs and they don't have maids and they don't have that. No. They might have someone once a week or twice a week. But what my point is that in return for not having that stuff, the reason they can't have that is because the average person who offers those services actually charges quite a bit for those services. So they're not cheap. But everyone gets to engage in the economy in that system.
Yeah.
In South Africa, we have diminishing what you can get for your money, same as Australia, except for the fact that nobody's getting raised up by that. That money's all being sucked into the black hole that is the government.
Yeah, that's true.
There's the reason.
I mean, once people realize that, you know, the ANC's been using South African economy as a piggy bank for the past 25 years and will continue to do so.
And doesn't intend to stop.
No, and will continue to do so. I mean, if I was, you know, it's like the CEO literally taking everyone's pension money every month and stashing it into his offshore bank accounts. That's exactly the same sort of thing that they are doing. And until you realize that it's a mafia and not a political party, we call it politics and we call it all this, you know, all this euphemistic stuff to make it seem legitimate, but it is illegitimate. It's a mafia of which 25% of all South Africans voted for. Only 43% of all electorate the people who could vote voted for. They don't have a popular mandate for any of this stuff. So, you know, to assume that they're a legitimate government authority in any single way is very mistaken, I'm afraid to say. And at this stage, I've been thinking this for quite a few years, but if you vote ANC, it's sort of treasonous or, you know, an enemy of the people at this stage. And if you point your vote for them, well, you deserve everything you get, which will be nothing, essentially. And look, I stopped feeling sorry for people long, long, long time ago, I must be honest. Because, they're holding us to ransom.
Is there anything to be said of, and without straying into the soft bigotry of low expectations, but you've got a government who has, some would say by incompetence and some would say by design, poorly educated a populace.
Mm.
And continues to poorly educate a populace, even though it's been pointed out to them that this populace is being poorly educated.
Yeah.
And so the people who say it's by design are saying, look, they're educating for stupid so that they carry on getting the vote.
Yeah, it's by design, but through incompetence. So, I mean, where did the power come from? Being in power with SATU. Cyril went to SATU first.
Sure. But so do you feel sorry for those people then? Would you believe that there's someone who finishes school, turns 18 and still votes for the ANC because they don't know any better? They really don't have the skills to be able to know better.
No, they don't know any better. And that's fine. I can't change that. But I don't want to be held hostage by them or their ignorance or their lack of savviness or whatever the case might be. The adults, they have full responsibility for their actions. And I'll judge them based on their actions. The time has passed where we stop blaming the victim.
Well, that's a good point. I also find this, it's almost like a game that it just repeats. It's like we keep restarting the board game. And the board game is the government does something heinous. The journalists then report on the heinous thing.
Yeah.
First, the government denies they did the heinous thing. Then the journalists report on it. Sometimes there's a bit of investigation. It comes out, blows up. Ooh, they did the heinous thing. Journalists pat themselves on the back. There's awards given and shit like that. this repeats again and again. Yeah. Arms deal, Nkandla.
Then there's internal investigations. Yeah. There's commission of inquiry.
So then there's a commission of inquiry, and the journalists go to the commission of inquiry and they write these extensive articles.
Oh my word, the judge said this.
Yeah, and we have like this controversy for weeks, and people are like, things really are working. You know, there's justice being served. And then nothing fucking happens, like nothing.
Until you realize it's all part of the same machine.
And then it is the same machine. And then we move on to the next
big thing.
We start the board game again and we go, and who knows what the next one will be. There'll be something else after SARS, like there was something else after Esidimeni, like there was something else after Nkandla, like there was something else after whatever else came before that and the arms deal all the way back when. It's just a million of these things. And I mean, my biggest issue with all of it is the lack of accountability.
Oh, throughout.
It drives me insane.
But there's no incentive to be accountable, Jonathan, because we've got a one-party state. There's no incentive whatsoever to be accountable. The media's not accountable. The politicians are not accountable. Government officials are probably the least accountable people here. You got Marco Lamberti, CEO of Imperial Holdings, yeah, who has a meeting with a
former CEO,
with an accountant, and he says, you know, and she wants the CFO job, and he says, I would love nothing more than an equity candidate to be CFO, but you're not yet qualified as yet. That she takes him to court and wins 23 million rand in defamation.
Yeah.
And that's how far the transformation narrative is. The ANC transformation narrative is a virus of the mind that has permeated throughout the entire chattering class of society.
And above, because for a judge to rule on that, the judge is not, theoretically not the chattering class.
So here's the deal. We're going to make quotas by law and force you to use them. But if you refer to anyone as a quota, it's defamation.
Yeah.
I mean, what fucking Orwellian nightmare are we in? Jonathan.
Yeah.
We're going to set the rules for you by force. And if you acknowledge that the rules are there, fuck you. We're going to take you to court for defamation. Yeah. What the fuck? Yeah. What is this? Yeah. And until the ANC lose power, as Leon Schreiber said a few weeks ago, until we have coalitions or until we break a one-party state, this bullshit is going to continue forever and ever and ever. And all the oppressive legislation, all the scandals, everything's going to be justified because transformation is what we actually want. And transformation can mean everything to everyone because the lefties love not having definitions. Or they just shift the goalposts whenever it chooses them. And the media and everyone else is rather complicit in all this. So, yeah, fuck everyone. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. Look, I think that's completely fair. Just on that last point about the left. Have you watched any of the recent stuff Dave Rubin did with Eric Weinstein and Jordan Peterson?
It's Weinstein. I watched half of it.
Yeah.
Weinstein's Harvey, the rapist. Weinstein is the intellectual dark web people. Big difference.
Whatever. Same Jewish tribe. So I just a point. Eric Weinstein was very good, and he's clearly a very smart guy. He pushes back a little bit against Jordan. So if you're not a Jordan fan, you might want to watch that. Specifically the one where it's just Jordan and Eric, as opposed to the one where Ben joins in and the conversation's a bit broader. Although it is an interesting conversation in that Eric is a leftist.
That's what he says.
So he falls, it's interesting where he falls on things. And I suppose, as we always say, that scale's quite hard to interpret these days. But I think I've said it before that Eric's the real problem. he's Eric and Brett and those guys are the real problem we're going to have to contend with when the SJWs are consigned to the trash heap of history, because they're far smarter in their motivation for taxation, for example. They're far smarter in their motivation for why we should use gendered pronouns. And why we should, I mean, Eric proposes changing the entire English language, and he gives quite a convincing argument. Yeah,
but I don't think they want to use coercion to do it, though. There's a big difference.
Well, Eric, it's funny because Eric tried to turn around and in that thing and say, we should use the intellectual dark web to enforce a way of thinking. And I sort of jumped back at that and went, you want to do what? That's kind of counterintuitive to the entire notion. So I worry that they may not want to use the state force, but they may want to use some sort of coercive force. Because for me, a leftist is a leftist is a leftist. And we're going to have this.
There's different types. There's different types. My favorite are the radical Marxists, which sort of acknowledge that capitalism, there's no alternative whatsoever currently, because capitalism absorbs every single anti-capitalist message, commodifies it, and sells it back to you. That's well, the beauty of
didn't
it.
Did you see that chick who won this Cortez chick?
Oh, the socialist.
Who won. She's going to basically be a congresswoman because she beat a guy in a district.
But I love her platform. Free healthcare for everyone, safety for everyone, open borders for everyone, money for everyone.
Her platform is a South African platform. Free housing, free healthcare, free job, guaranteed government job. Yeah. It's a South African platform. In fact, our constitution even sort of says it with regards to free housing. But what I did find funny was she was wearing a lipstick that people were commenting on, bright red lipstick. So she eventually came out and said, no, I've heard a lot of you asking me about my lipstick. It's this brand from such and such a place. And they sold out of the lipstick in like 5 hours.
There you go. You can commodify socialism.
Capitalism,
man.
For the win, man.
That's why Rage Against the Machine, one of the most Marxist punk bands ever, are massively rich. And that's why they sell anarchy stickers at fucking Typo, whatever it's called. Well. That's a bit of capitalism. If someone like Malema, the most intelligent leftist I know, say, the market works and we get that. We just need to tinker with it to get more equity and fairness in the system. Okay, cool. That is a good starting point. But if your starting point is capitalism is evil and rubbish and destroy and destructive, there's no hope in hell you can
win. My point is, both of them end up in the same spot, ultimately.
No, you can. No, I don't. In what way? The tinkering leads to destruction.
The tinkering, the guy who says we need to destroy it all and the government must control everything is the guy on the very far left. And the guy more to the center of the left sort of says, no, we just want to tinker with it a little bit. That tinkering ultimately always leads to more and more tinkering.
Yes.
And that's my problem.
But that's the notion of statism.
And if you leave them long enough, they'll tinker a little bit and you'll go, don't like it, but I'll let it go.
Yeah, but I don't think
and long enough, that becomes the far left.
But I don't think there is such a thing as a pure market in the state of society anyway. So all successive governments do is just tinker in different ways. And they tinker it and then they untinker it, the next government. Mm-hmm. Then the next one comes in, they tinker something, then they untinker it. All Trump does is like do away with regulations set by previous administrations. Like that's all he's done. And that makes him a Nazi.
Shall we end the show?
Well, we have to. Someone else needs a studio.
Cool.
Right. Well, thank you for listening. This was impromptu and off the cuff. We're actually getting quite good at this. I had no idea what to talk about.
Yeah. Other than at one point where we were just like, now what? But yeah, other than that.
At least be honest about it. We're not going to edit it out like some people we know.
Yeah. So thank you for listening, as Ramon said.
Sam Harris, I know you edit your podcast.
Sam, yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening. If you do enjoy the podcast, you're welcome to support us on Patreon. That is how we earn our funding. Unlike other shows, we are not funded by the Koch brothers. Although, if you are listening, we would love your money. And you can always find us on Facebook, Renegade Report, both the page and the group, where we have good discussions. Twitter @Renegade_Report, Ramon @RomanCabernack, myself @Jonathan_Witt. Thank you for listening and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.